School Leadership Podcast from NAHT Edge and NAHT.
Happy New Year and welcome to the first School Leadership Podcast of 2018, brought to you by NAHT Edge and NAHT.
This is the School Leadership Podcast.
This year, we're looking forward to bringing you some of the most influential and interesting voices from the world of education. And this first episode is no exception. Our special guest this month is Dr. Becky Allen. Becky's well known to many school leaders and teachers through her work at Education Data Lab. In this interview, our Edge Director James Bowen covers a range of topics with Becky, from Ofsted to teacher workload. At the end of last year, Becky announced she'd be leaving Education Data Lab to move on to a new role at the Institute of Education. And James began by asking her what exactly this role would entail.
So first of all, can I congratulate you on your new post at the IOE? Tell us a bit about what that's going to involve, and can you reassure us that you'll carry on being an influential voice when it comes to schools and education policy for the foreseeable future?
So I'm going to set up a new research centre. It's going to be called the Centre for Education Improvement Science, and I hope we're going to be able to do a very wide variety of work, trying to look at scientific inquiry into how children learn, how teacher careers should work, and how schools should work as organisations. So I very much hope I will be continuing some of the work that I've done in the past, but I think the breadth of what we aspire to do within the centre is much wider, and it will be a much larger centre.
And so then, reflecting back on your time at Education Data Lab, which was that 5 years now, 4 or 5 years?
3 years.
Only 3 years?
Yeah.
So what do you feel you've achieved in that time? What sort of difference do you think Education Data Lab's made to how sort of schools operate and education policy in general?
I like to think that we've been really helpful to many schools in understanding the data that government uses to hold them to account. I think we've done a good job at keeping both DfE around the performance tables and Ofsted in check about the way that they're using data, highlighting times they're using data in ways that's unfair or invalid. And I think we've shown the face of the ugly underbelly of school accountability. And I think that is the things that we wish head teachers didn't do in schools, but we think that they do because they're under enormous pressure. So some of the things that we've really highlighted, well, the biggest one is the off-rolling of pupils, particularly in secondary school, where we've seen over the past decade a massive, massive rise in the number of children around the age of 14 and 15 who were off-rolled from mainstream education somewhere else, often into homeschooling, into alternative provision, into unregulated or semi-regulated private provision. And this is a direct consequence of running an incredibly high-stakes accountability system. But we've highlighted other things that happen as well. Lots of the inconsistency around the grading of GCSEs and, more importantly, non-GCSEs, and a lot of the gaming that goes on where schools are strategically making decisions about the GCSE subject offer, not by thinking first what are in the best interests of the pupils, but thinking what will maximise their performance table position. And I think that that has directly led the government to make decisions about which non-GCSE qualifications will be permissible in the tables. In the case of primary schools, the biggest issue I guess we've been talking about has been the moderation of the Key Stage 2 writing. Which we've consistently shown has been a major problem, and it's been a major problem for the accountability system.
Do you think we're in a good place now when it comes to kind of evidence-based policy and I suppose how schools are using evidence and data to make decisions? Has that improved, do you think, over the last sort of few years?
I think we're in an interesting place. I think we're in a place where I think we know we would like to be able to use evidence much better to make decisions, and I think there are a lot of heads who really do want to make evidence-based decisions. I think we're also in a position where we know how little we know, and unfortunately it is still the case that almost every decision a head teacher has to take, there isn't a great evidence base around what they should be doing. And that's a really tough situation to be in. I think that speaks to the fact that in some respects education research overall hasn't moved forward quite as much as we'd like it to in the past 30 years. I think it also speaks to the fact that in 2010, when we started the Educational Endowment Foundation, I think we had this idea that we would run a load of randomised control trials and just find out what works, and then we'd just do that. Only it turns out that most things don't work. At least they don't work within the confines of the way they're being measured in the trials. And I think that that is a challenge for both the EEF and for the profession. And I think there's some reasons for that. Education, as we all know, is an incredibly complex thing, and things are interdependent. And it takes time to bed in change. So sometimes if you turn around to a teacher and say, you're taking part in a randomised controlled trial and you need to try doing this following thing differently, that might actually make things worse. And it's not because the thing you're proposing is a bad thing. It's just that disruption is hard for teachers. And teaching heavily, because it's so complex, relies on habits and being able to automate what you do as a teacher. And therefore, you have to be very careful with teachers about how much you ask them to change. And we really need to know where are the big important bets around how we should be trying to break teachers' habits and change classroom practice. And we probably don't want to do that too much.
So do you think kind of a truly evidence-based approach to teaching in schools is almost unachievable because it's so complex? Or should we still be aiming for that? Is that something we should be within our grasp?
One of the things that I've come round to thinking rather late in my life is that we need to pay more attention to both having a very strong theoretical underpinning to education research, to our ideas of how humans interact when they lead schools and teach, so psychological theories of motivation and behaviour and so on, and also how the brain works. And the reason why I've come to that position is if we don't have that, all we can ever try to do is research around the so-called what works agenda, where we're kind of testing widgets at random and seeing if we can make them work. And the problem with that is that we never build up any lasting body of evidence that has any kind of permanency or ever develops our perspectives on the things that ultimately are important, which is, I think, that we develop a better understanding of how the adults in schools should work around and with each other and how children learn. So I'm still optimistic we can do a lot better, but I think it's a lot harder than people first thought, and I think we have to be more conscious of building up theoretical ideas about education policy.
And you talked there about human interactions and what have you, and I think that leads us nicely on to a speech you gave recently on teacher workload, because I think there's a lot in here around human interaction. It was a fascinating speech, and you used this amazing phrase, institutional isomorphism, which is hard to say. I wonder if you could sort of say a bit more about what that means, because I think a lot of people sort of heard that speech or read it and thought that exactly sort of captures what's going on in schools.
The idea is that we have this system of 22,000 schools who have all chosen to change the way that the teaching job is. And the central thesis that I had within my speech was that there has been a change, and there has been a change since I stopped being a teacher, for example. And that is that when I was a teacher, essentially teaching was a private endeavour. And what went on in the classroom was known by me, and it was known by the children. And unless another adult was in the room, they simply didn't know what was going on. And at some point we changed that. And we developed the thing that in the speech I call the audit culture. This idea that somehow we need to ask teachers to account for what's going on in their classrooms to people who are not there at the time. And so I asked myself, how on earth did the profession collectively decide that they wanted to do this? Because when you look back in time, nobody ever told them that this had to happen. And there was never overnight a policy pronouncement that they must do this. So the idea of the isomorphism is a group of schools all choosing to move and herd in the same direction, not necessarily with an obvious lead. So in this speech, I explore these three reasons why I think this is happening. And one is the reason that schools will readily identify with, and this is what I call the coercive isomorphism, which principally, more than anything, is Ofsted, but it's also the performance tables driving particular behaviour. And within the speech, I said that there is a reason why Ofsted came to see paperwork as even more important than they ever had in the past, and that was the change in the inspection regime. When we moved from long to short inspections, we could no longer have an inspection where the idea of the inspection itself was that the inspectors uncovered evidence of what the school was like. Instead, all they're capable of doing now is going in and checking whether the head teacher knows their school and whether the head teacher can produce evidence that they know their school. And this is the production of the audit culture. But I also talked about the other forces that push things in place. And one was the mimetic isomorphism. So this is the mimicking behaviour of schools where, because as we discussed earlier, we don't really know how to make schools good and produce good schooling and good learning environments. We find head teachers who don't know what to do to make their schools good trying to just mimic each other. And mimicking can be really helpful if you think of sheep herding, it's always safer to be in the herd, even if the herd itself is going in the wrong direction. And my fear is that that was what we did. But I also talk about the culture, what we call the normative isomorphism, the things that drive us as a profession towards high workload, and some of the things that I think have got a lot worse in the profession as a result. So for teachers, we've long developed this idea, and I don't think it was always present, but it is now, that firstly, it is up to us to have absolute autonomy about what we do in the classroom, and to that end, we will produce our curriculum, our schemes of work, our daily lesson plans, all of which produces a huge workload for the teachers, and it's one of their choosing. They want this autonomy, and the consequences is a very high workload. But also, we've had this development, I think, over the past 15 years or so, that teachers somehow can change the position of children in society and how well they can do. And once you get yourself into the position where you believe you can change things, it feels great because it makes you feel important as a teacher. But it also can really overwhelm you because you develop this sense that if any of your children are failing, that somehow there's something it is possible for you to do to make it better, and therefore you should. And there are lots of things that have changed to that end around teachers feeling that they should be running after school clubs, should be coming in over Easter to run revision sessions, because they feel that it is their job to make sure that children succeed.
So it's almost as a danger that, you know, teachers can have a great impact on children's lives, but then that in itself becomes a problem, because if you can have an impact, you put it as sort of a burden on yourself.
That's
to work every single child, to close the gap for every single class, etc., etc. So is that part of the problem?
Absolutely, yeah. And it's a kind of transfer of agency, if you like, from the child to the teacher. And much as we don't like to admit it as teachers, you know, a lot of the success or otherwise of children doesn't have a lot to do with what goes on in the classroom. And that's not really part of the narrative of education at the moment. The narrative at the moment is it's within our gift to make sure every child succeeds. I'm not saying it is or isn't. I'm saying if you have that narrative, it's not surprising that workload spirals out of control. But to talk about head teachers, they have their own normative isomorphism, in the sense that for this generation of head teachers now, they have grown up in an era where they think the job of a head teacher is to collect documentary evidence on what is going on throughout their school. And because they think that's their job, that is what they do. And anyone who doesn't think that that's the job of a head teacher doesn't get to be in leadership anymore. And anyone who doesn't want to do that doesn't get to be in leadership anyway. And this is reinforced not just by the head teachers themselves, but by people who appoint heads, by governing bodies, by local authority and multi-academy trust advisors who come round and have developed this shared understanding of what it means to be a leader. And a leader has to collect documentary evidence of what is going on in the school. And it feels almost unthinkable to heads today that we just shouldn't have all this information and that we could just delete it all and carry on.
It takes sort of courageous leadership, wouldn't it, to break out from that mould and say, do you know what, we don't need that old audit culture anymore. There's going to be a high level of trust, far less about evidence gathering. But I guess that's what you're saying, that's the solution, really. That's what we need people to do.
My argument as to why we need to address this is, firstly, that we know standards haven't risen. We know that from both international studies, and we know that from studies conducted by people like Cambridge Assessment, who collect repeated measures of how children do in maths tests over long periods of time and so on. Right. So we know that. We are not producing, through this audit culture, massive systemic improvement in the schooling system. But my bigger concern is that we drive teachers out of the profession who feel that they can't handle being managed in that kind of way with that audit culture. And my contention about teaching, at least teaching today, is that we need it needs to be a prestigious profession, and we need autonomous professionals who can make and who enjoy having autonomy and want to make professional judgments about how to do their job. The reason why I think that is simply that we just don't have the scientific evidence to be prescriptive about how teachers should do their job. I wish we did. I wish we could tell teachers exactly what they should be doing in their classroom every moment of the day, but we don't have that evidence. Because we don't have that evidence, we need talented, autonomous professionals. And my very fear, I think my long-standing fear, is that the kind of people who taught me, I know they're now retired, they look in horror at what the job is like today. And my fear is that for my children, those kind of people are choosing not to be teachers today.
Is that, it's an overused phrase, but the kind of the maverick teacher, there is no place for them anymore. The ones who did things slightly differently, but, you know, for whatever reason were memorable and fantastic teachers, that they just don't kind of fit within the profession anymore.
Yeah, I don't know how I personally would handle being a teacher today. I don't know, perhaps I would. Perhaps I would get acclimatised to the way that the job is today. But I think this idea that somehow we can plan and homogenise practice, I think it's still a little bit of a pipe dream. And we know that we're in a chronic recruitment crisis. We know the reality is that anybody can apply to become a teacher and anybody can be a teacher. And we're in a worse position than we've ever been before for that. And think we have to ask ourselves why. And we have to ask ourselves how many teachers today are going out there to their friends and their relatives saying, yes, you should become a teacher because do you know what? It's a fantastic job.
So when it comes to solutions then with workload, I don't know how you feel about kind of government's recent initiatives to sort of tackle workload with the reports and what have you. Do you think there are obvious things that we need to happen if we're really going to properly tackle the workload issue?
Yes, I think we can tackle it if we want to. I think we have to just take away the audit culture. We have to stop doing it. It's not to say that teachers won't choose to collect data. When I was a teacher, I used to carry around a mark book and put whatever scribbles I fancied in it. And you have to do that as a secondary school teacher because you're teaching over 200 children. You can't hold that information in your head. But to make it the teacher's domain again, I cannot see any reason why we should not do that. And I talk about that in the speech. Can we do that? Can all teachers cope with the trust culture? No, of course not. And we have to hope that we can find a way to manage those who can't cope with it out of the profession, which is a tough thing to say. But we have to do that to maintain the trust culture for everybody else. So that tackles part of the problem. The major part of the problem for most teachers is around addressing marking. And part of marking is bound up in audit. Part of it is bound up in schools believing that parents want to see these things. Part of it is bound up in teachers having done it for so long that they can't believe that you can teach whilst marking a lot less or marking in different ways. And by that, we're talking about, you know, students marking in class, peer marking, whole class marking, you know, all the alternatives that there are. So part of it is to ask teachers, show teachers the alternatives, ask them to experiment for themselves and ask them to figure out for themselves how they can make their own job more manageable. We'll always have teachers who want to do 70 hours a week. And that's fine, because we have them in every profession. The really important thing is that we need to have a profession where people can come to school, they can teach, and then they can go home and they can see their family. The reason why we need that is because the thing about teaching is it involves being around children. So it's kind of helpful if the people who do it like children, which means it's likely that they like their own children, which means it's helpful if that they can get home and see their own children. And we just have to accept that. We can't pretend that we can be like law or banking and have long hour culture. We can't pretend that because we can't pay enough. And we can't pretend that because we won't get the right kind of people to be teachers. And I just think we can go back to that age. We can work out how to do the job in shorter hours, and we have to do it.
I want to go back to the topic of Ofsted now, because we've touched on it, we've mentioned it a few times. I think it's pretty fair to say that in the past you've not been afraid to be critical of Ofsted, where you think they're getting it wrong. You've talked about, you know, the coercive influence it can have at times. If you like, what do you think, what concerns you around the way Ofsted operates? Is it about the impact it has on disadvantaged schools? Is it the reliability? What causes you concern?
I have written in the past that I'm really concerned about the reliability of the inspection itself. I think I've written about how if inspectors walk into schools and they only have a very, very short time to inspect, they have to make quick decisions. And when humans need to make quick decisions, they employ heuristics, shortcuts, cognitive shortcuts to try and form views of what they're seeing. And as humans, we carry with us all kinds of biases. We carry, particularly as inspectors, all the biases that we've learned through our own career, usually having been a head ourselves. We view the head who we meet the moment we walk in for an inspection, and we form a view of them partly based on how they remind us of people we've known in the past. We are heavily influenced by things we learned and believed to be true whilst we were head teachers. So all of these things, I think, lead me to have concerns about the validity of the judgment and it's made in itself. Now, as it happens in the modern age, they rely massively on the data judgment. And the judgments that are made do veer from the data judgment sometimes. So one piece of research we did is we said, well, when the judgment that we would make based on data alone and the judgment that's made by an Ofsted inspector, where in the past they've differed, has that Ofsted inspector seen something in the school that we can't see in the data? And we formed the thesis that one of the things they might be seeing is change that's taking place in a school. Because when you look at exam results, whether they're age 11 or age 16, they tell you about the experience of children who've left, about the past. And they don't tell you about the experience of children at the time. So we said, really, is what the inspector's doing identifying schools on the cusp of improvement or on the cusp of deterioration? And is that the reason why the judgments they're making are misaligned? And to which the answer was no, they were not. So this led me to have further concerns. Essentially, when the judgments are being made in a way that's not aligned with the data, it's happening in really quite a random way that's not aligned.
Is it a bit of a catch-22, though? I think most school leaders would say, look, I don't want an inspection to be based on purely data alone.
Yeah.
I want a more rounded judgment. Mm. But then if we have a more rounded judgment, we have to accept the fact it's going to be perhaps less reliable. Is that, you know, just
absolutely
something we just have to live with?
And I absolutely do not want an accountability system based on data alone, especially not the state of the data that we're judging schools on at the moment, right? So I don't think the data on schools is correct and is the answer. I also think there's stuff that goes on in schools that's incredibly important that's not captured by exam scores. And I want human beings to tell us stuff about what's going on in schools outside it. I think we've got to the point now, though, with the short inspection, where it's not telling us the thing that we need it to tell us. I think it's possible for human beings to walk into schools and learn a lot about what's going on. I think that probably happened under the historic inspection regime that took place in the past, where you would have reams of inspectors turn up, including subject specialists. They'd hang out in a subject department for a whole week in a secondary school, really, as I say, kind of learning about the school and uncovering evidence. I think that can tell you about schools. Mm. I think it's also really, really expensive. So I think we're reaching a milestone, I think, where we have to make a decision about where we go from here with the accountability system, because I think there's a growing acceptance that it's creaking at the seams, but nobody feels that we can just walk away and say, well, performance tables are wrong, inspection's not working, so let's just forget the whole thing. We can't do that. We've got to think again about what we really need in the system to make sure the system's fit for purpose. And part of the bit that I think has always been missing is we've never thought enough about what is the critically important thing that we're always doing in our system. And that is that we're identifying a set of schools, it might be less than 500 at any point in time, that are in desperate need of support to get better. And when you say that is the thing we really desperately need in the system and we need the support for them, you end up, I think, inventing something that looks very different from the current accountability system.
So does that leads me to think about the use of grading in general, and also, you know, with around reliability and validity and whatever. Where do you stand on the use of grades, or the grading system as it stands, where you've got kind of four grades? Mm. You know, how reliable is it that a good school is, you know, comparable to another good school, that actually you haven't got a school that's better, that's actually got an RI label? Yeah. Where do you sort of sit with the idea of those four offset grades?
I'm not sure that we need them, which really brings me back to I'm not sure how much value there is in giving a school a label if the label doesn't come with anything that goes with it. And by that I mean the support that the school needs. I'm not particularly in favour of giving schools grades because I don't think we need them. I think implicitly we have that sort of ranking taking place for better or worse through the performance tables, and that's enough.
And I want to finish by asking you, while you're here, about particularly around sort of the primary assessment consultation.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think government are moving in the right direction with this? Obviously, quite a large number of proposals in terms of the way primary assessment will be going forwards, with a sort of proposals for a baseline to year six measure and other things as well. What did you think of it overall?
I think it depends whether you want to radically shake things up or tweak things on the margin. I'm not really against having an age four baseline at all. And that's partly because I think it's completely crazy that we're running performance tables with an age seven starting point.
Do you think a baseline can work? Because there's been quite a bit of, you know, some people would say, well, you can't possibly do a baseline for children of that age. Do you feel it's doable?
So I've seen the data from the Durham longitudinal study, and that's really the only study that I know of that's around that can tell you how predictive is an age four score for age 11 attainment, and how predictive is it relative to the status quo. And the status quo is really quite a poor key stage one metric, and that shows it's good enough. I'm not saying it's brilliant. I mean, the reality is that for a one form primary school, we're not in great shape for ever managing to say they're unusually good or unusually bad, because the school's too small and we've got too much sampling error and noise on imprecision on the metrics and everything else. But I don't think we end up in a worse position than we are at the moment with a pretty poor key stage one metric.
So overall, you think it's not bad if we're sort of seeing it as a kind of improving slightly, but it's not a radical...
Absolutely. I mean, my radical views is that my greatest concern is not whether the data is valid. I understand that head teachers want to be judged fairly. I don't care about that. I care about is the assessment system driving nice behaviour in schools, the kind of behaviour that leads my children to have a good education? My concern is that when we have these very, very prescriptive tests that we have at the moment that tell schools exactly what's going to be tested on, actually they don't test most of the national curriculum. It leads to widespread distortions. My preference, and this would horrify most head teachers, I know it horrifies head teachers, but I think it's held by lots and lots of assessment experts, is that the government simply says to primary schools, please set aside the third week in May or whatever week we choose where your children will be tested on aspects of the national curriculum. And it just says that, and that's all. It can be any child in the school. It can be any element of the national curriculum. And the only way that a school can do well in that test is to teach the national curriculum. And we're not going to tell you what the question styles are going to be like, and we're not going to tell you exactly what elements will and won't get tested, what year groups from one year to the next, nothing. And for me, that would produce the healthiest most well-balanced education for children, which is the thing that I care about. It would lead to very, very noisy measures. It would mean that from one year to the next, exam results would veer about wildly for schools. But all that would reflect is actually the imprecision that we have in reality about how good schools are. And I'm not saying by that all schools are equally good, or that some schools are good at some things and some schools aren't. I'm just saying that our capacity to measure how good schools are, particularly small primary schools, with relatively short tests, is really, really limited.
NAHT Edge is a union and professional association aimed at teachers with leadership responsibilities. Whether you're a subject coordinator, year leader, key stage leader, early years leader, Senko, or head of department, we offer full trade union protection and high quality advice. In addition, our weekly newsletter and monthly podcast keeps you up to speed with the latest developments in education. Membership of NAHT Edge costs just £13.50 a month. Find out more by visiting www.nahtedge.org.uk.
Teaching. Leadership. And the latest developments in schools.
Thanks ever so much for taking the time to listen to this episode of the School Leadership Podcast. If there's a particular guest you'd like to hear from, an expert in future episodes, please do get in touch through email or send us a message via our Twitter or Facebook accounts. Don't forget, if you've enjoyed this podcast, you can make sure you receive every episode as soon as it becomes available by subscribing on iTunes. Why not also leave a review? We'd love to hear from you. We'll see you next time. NAHT is a professional association and union for school leaders. NAHT Edge is the part of our association aimed specifically at aspirational middle leaders. To discover more about the benefits of being an NAHT Edge or NAHT member, go online to nahtedge.org.uk/join or www.nahtedge.org.uk/join. You can follow us on Twitter @NAHT Edge and @NAHT News.